Hi, this is Bill Bellows with the Better Thinking About seminar, our webinar series. This month, the topic, Better Thinking About Our Brains. Here we are on Thursday, February 12th at 11:30 in Los Angeles. I'd like to welcome Elaine Johnson as our third seminar leader. Go ahead, Elaine, and thanks again.
Okay, thank you very much, Bill, and I'm pleased that so many of you with such a varied interest have tuned in to see what you can pick up about the brain. My interest today is to try to suggest some of the major discoveries that have been made about the brain and to indicate why they matter to organizations and, in fact, matter to us. And so I would suggest that the most important thing that we've learned so far since early 1990 about the brain has been that it has plasticity, and all of you undoubtedly are very much aware of this. And so you take a look at all of the crinkly things in the brain and you realize that the brain's neuron, one kind of brain cell, the brain has two kinds of cells, right? Glial cells and neurons. Well, the neurons carry the electrical and chemical signals and they are not fixed. Many of them are not fixed. They can wire in new ways and they can rewire. So what's really critical for our purposes is this marvelous news that these fibers in the brain can actually connect and change their connection, and in altering, they do change the brain's physical structure. Now that means that our experiences change the physical structure of our individual brains. And this is simply an image of axons that carry the electrical chemical signals and go to a particular neuron and make a connection. And I'm not interested so much today in talking about how the brain works, but just to show you a few images. For example, here are two neurons, and you can see that they're clearly connecting, and they connect just as you look at this image. As you look at this image on the screen, your neurons are forming circuits. And the more you attend to this image, the more likely it is that that image will remain in your brain. And so you see the axon fiber acting on the other neurons to make the connection. And what's wonderful about plasticity is that it makes the brain grow. That is to say, your brain does have neurons which contain not only the axon, one axon carrying a signal, but hundreds of fibers to receive signals. So here's a neuron. I don't know, can you see my cursor pointing? I suppose not. But if you look on the left, you see on the screen particular black circles. Well, that's the heart of the neuron. That's the essential core of the neuron. And then coming out are all of these fibers. And some of those fibers, most of them are called dendrites. They receive signals. And the more signals you send, the more your brain is asked to work, the more dendrites it grows. So Al, who's retired and trying to keep his brain fresh, can tell himself that he's going to grow dendrites, and that's precisely what we do. It's a remarkable thing, the plasticity of the brain. And so, not only do neurons connect and do dendrites grow, but we can actually alter regions of our brain. And so the blind have keen hearing, and they also have a keen sense of touch, which is what I wish I had written here. Blind children can't use their visual cortex, the part of the brain that's meant for seeing. But if they learn Braille, and they keep working at it before the age of 15, certainly they develop a tremendous neuronal circuitry that handles touch. And so they form touch circuits that help their fingers interpret Braille. And so I want you to realize that experience alters whole areas of the brain, whole regions of the brain. And so here are the regions. This wrinkled part of the brain is the cortex, and what it does is serve as a very thin covering for the entire brain, but the cortex is loaded with neurons that do all sorts of things for us. And so we talk about it as divided into sections or regions. The frontal lobe is the part that's responsible chiefly for your personality, for your sense of self, for your movement, your ability to move, for your thinking. It's the part that really, above all, makes you human. The parietal lobe is the area that handles touch. It also handles spatial relationships and keeps you from recognizing stairs and not not falling down them. It tells you where things are. The temporal lobe contains the audio cortex. It does all kinds of things that enable us to filter sounds and hear. And it tells us, in addition, what things are. So the temporal lobe will help you figure out that you're looking at a maple leaf and not a bush leaf, or you're looking at a tree and not a lamppost. And the occipital lobe in the very back of the brain contains the visual cortex. Okay, now notice, the parietal lobe handles touch, the occipital lobe handles the visual cortex. And before about 1990, what scientists thought was that a blind person couldn't process any kind of visual sensation, therefore the area of the brain meant to handle visual sensations sat idle, like an empty warehouse, wasn't used, didn't do anything. Now we've learned that in fact, if, as I say, a blind person works with Braille, that parietal zone is taken over entirely by neurons that deal with touch. So, so here you have an image, and the lighted up part up above, on top, is the parietal lobe, which you would expect to be lighted up when somebody is actually working with Braille. But what you see down at the bottom of this, that small pear area at the bottom, is the visual cortex, and it's lighted up. And that's quite remarkable. It means that touch neurons live there now, have taken it over, and enable this person to see. Now, one of the things that helps the brain's plasticity, that helps us to make these marvelous shifts in the physical structure of our brain, are mirror neurons. And mirror neurons, recently discovered, are very special neurons that fire when you pick up a pencil, and also fire when you watch your friend pick up a pencil. They fire when you cry, and they fire when you watch someone else cry. And so, to put it differently, mirror neurons have a double function. They fire when we act, when we do something, when we perform an action, when we feel an emotion. But remarkably, they fire when we watch someone else acting or feeling. And so, for example, these gentlemen playing soccer, kicking the ball, running, pushing each other, in their brains are processing all of that, the whole complex series of activities in which they're engaged. And as you watch them on the soccer field, the very same parts of your brain are active as you watch them kick and run. You're imitating what they're doing in your brain. Your brain is performing their action. It's really sort of astonishing. And so when you look at anxious David here, and you worry about old David, what happens is you're observing his anxiety, and your mirror neurons catch his anxiety, which means you should hang out with pleasant people. Because if you're hanging out with really anxious people, your mirror neurons are going to imitate their anxiety. And the consequence is going to be that your body will endure the anxiety and the stress of anxiety that comes with having caught it from them. You're worried about them and accordingly. Now, mirror neurons work really well in adults and in young people. So this particular child, presumably, easily imitates behavior he observes. Now, the point of all of this for organizations, of course, is that people do bring their brains to the workplace. And they have amazing plasticity. And their mirror neurons are activated, and that makes them absorb and respond to and be physically altered by the nature, the culture of the place where they go to work. And another thing to realize is that the brain, as surely as it has plasticity and possesses mirror neurons, is also hardwired to be moral. We're actually born with neurons that are wired with the ability to distinguish right from wrong. And so research has indicated that even one-year-olds have a moral sense, a sense of what's right and isn't. And they've proved this in, it was research too complicated to go into, but it's a fact. Toddlers try to comfort somebody who might be hurt and to protect them from a wrong thing. And preschoolers certainly know wrong behavior from right, and in many cases, research has asked them to demonstrate it. So you bring to the workplace a brain that is not only disposed to be moral and to judge between right and wrong, but a brain that has certain moral beliefs. Now, it's thought that some moral beliefs are shared by all human beings. They're universal. Do no harm. Now, do no harm isn't just a negative enjoinder. It actually means prevent people from suffering hardship or prevent people from being exploited. Okay, now, there are lots of ways in which we can constructively construe the mandate to do no harm. To be fair, to support the community, to respect authority, and to be pure. Now, those are, in a sense, universal mandates. But if you think about it for an organization, being fair would suggest the importance of honoring commitments. The brain wants you to keep your promises to employees. It wants you to keep your promises to suppliers. Your brain flourishes when it observes fairness. In fact, there's an ultimatum game that you've probably heard about, and what it entails is that two people will be given, let's say, $100, and one of the people, both of them are permitted to keep all of the money depending on how the sharing goes. If the guy who has $100 in his hand offers money to his co-experimenter, to his partner, and that partner rejects it, neither of them gets anything. Nobody gets any money at all. If the partner accepts what is proffered, they both keep what they have. Okay, so I've got $100 and I offer you $10, and you reject it. So I don't get $100 and you don't get anything at all. Now, pure reason says a little money is better than no money. So you figure the guy with $100 who gives somebody $10, well, the man receiving the $10 will keep it, because any money is better than no money. But he doesn't keep it. Typically, research suggests that when the ultimatum game is worked out, people keep what's fair. They want fair treatment. So they'll keep 50% and be happy with it. And interestingly, usually the guy who has $100 will offer half in a sense of fairness. So fairness is fundamental to human conduct in organizations that feature it, that keep their word, that follow through on what they say, tend to be healthier and to thrive more than those that are duplicitous. The sense of community, respect for community, supporting the community is an obvious thing to talk about in relationship, of course, to organizations, because what it indicates is how important it is that one be loyal and respectful and to contribute to the well-being of the community. Now, the thing is, these are universal values, but the bottom line in this slide says many moral beliefs are local. Now, what that suggests, of course, is that our moral sense of what's right and what's wrong is very much influenced by our immediate culture. Our context, our culture, our immediate environment does shape our brain, even in the sense of its morality. And so if you take a look, the brain is flexible. It is plastic. It does have mirror neurons that imitate. It is hardwired to judge some things right and others wrong, and it even has these universal perceptions. But the workplace has its own culture. It's imposing its own local morality. So when people bring their brains to work, the brain can be very much rewired with workplace values. And the problem is that these values can, in fact, distort. The morality of the workplace may not be a desirable morality. Now, the trouble is, people with undue power, as this parent in relation to the child, people with undue power can